Your conference is being recorded.
So, for example, we did the island called Standard 6, which is special solution in our K-12, and they're all open.
Hi, who's on the phone? Anybody?
It's Ross here from Arcadia.
Hello, I'm sorry, again?
Ross Mount from Arcadia.
Who else we have?
We have Yvonne from MIT.
Hi, Yvonne. Thank
Hi.
You. Lunch was tremendous, Yvonne. Thank you for
all
the choices.
Right. I'm so glad.
Let me see if they can hear.
Who else do we have? Yeah, I guess I don't have to.
This is Jeff Uboy.
Hi, Jeff. Thank you for joining. Can you guys hear me
okay?
We're dealing with some new technology here that none of us, we're all a little skeptical about. Can you hear me okay as I just sort of talk in the room?
Sounds great.
Good.
You sound crystal.
Yeah. Hi, everyone. I guess you should, after such a lunch, you should welcome us. Yeah.
Well, we're just, doing our sound check. Could you hear Peter okay?
Yes.
He sounded all right. He sounded just a little far.
A little far. Okay. So we'll have to make sure we're speaking up from the far side. Okay. Well, you've got draping all around. So let's get Annika on it. Thank you. And we've got cabling all around. So we'll see. All right, well, we're just wrapping up lunch, and we'll get started here in just a minute. Everybody got something to eat. Welcome. Welcome to Maryland. For those of you I don't know, I'm MJ Bishop. I direct the Kerwin Center for Academic Innovation at the University System of Maryland. College Park is one of our 12 institutions, but we also serve a wide range of regional comprehensives, our three HBCUs, the professional schools up in Baltimore, just a whole wide range of institutions. My offices are actually just around the corner, though, so it does feel like, kind of this is our home base down here in College Park. Thanks for the additional folks who've come on board into this conversation. We met when was the last meeting? It was in I can't even remember what time of year it is, so it must have been in the spring. in May at MIT. Had a really great initial conversation that I know you've had a chance to read some of those notes and get filled in on. And one of the things that we talked about while we were all there, too, was, the open conversation has morphed into something I think even larger and bigger than any of us would have anticipated 20 years ago, 25 years ago. You know, I feel like a relative newbie to this discussion compared to Hal and some of the others in the room that have been doing this work for so long. For me, you know, it's, and for Mark McBride and for Richard and some of the others in the room, we're kind of in the boots on the ground, okay, how are we going to roll up our sleeves and get this work done mode? So after that conversation in May, we talked a little bit about how we might extend invitations even more broadly to include even more of the folks that have been doing that work in this discussion too, because what I've been seeing in the statewide initiative that we've been running, which is the Maryland Open Source Textbook Initiative, is that we've needed to work hard at shifting the conversation. You know, we've had a lot of folks really excited about the free part of OER, which has been tremendous and has accomplished huge things for our students and the people that we've been serving. But trying to recast and get our faculty, our administration, our legislators to understand it's really the open part that we ought to be really excited about. And figuring out how to make that transition in the conversation is a big part of what those of us that are doing the work on the ground have been wrestling with and trying to figure out how to manage. So we're excited to be part of this conversation. We think that's a big part of what Open 2020 may need to look like, in addition to a lot of other things that we're going to be talking about for the next 24 hours or so. And we're really just really glad to have everybody here. So thanks for joining us, and I think I'm to kick it over to Hal, is that right? To you guys.
Yeah, to us, and then we'll kick it over to Hal, and then
okay.
And I just want to say that Kurt and I were sitting here a little while ago, but that looked too much like the Ukrainian Supreme Soviet. which we might be answering to at some point. we decided to move over here. I'm not sure that's any better, but.
Yeah, so again, just wanted to welcome everybody here. We're so glad you can join us. And I think we wanted to kick things off, actually, with just going around and introducing ourselves, reintroducing ourselves. I think a lot of us know each other, but maybe not everybody knows everybody. So our name, our affiliation, and if you are new to this conversation, one of the things we did at our first meeting, and it's pretty well documented on the wiki, which hopefully everybody's had a chance to check out, is vision statements, what we hope for within our own particular domain, our own slice through this broader space. If you have anything that you wanted to share along those lines, love to hear that. So, I'm Kurt Newton from MIT. My vision statement is up on the wiki.
Joe Caragana from Columbia. I've been, for the most part, somebody who works on informal media economies and access to knowledge as a researcher. But more recently, I'm the director of something called the Open Syllabus Project, which has interesting implications for how we think about the OER ecosystem and some broader questions about openness around curricular data.
I'm Amy Brand. I'm the director of the MIT Press and of something called the MIT Knowledge Futures Group. And I'm particularly interested in open sustainability and open infrastructure and how we, you know, for this group, how we broaden the conversation beyond OER to open scholarship more broadly.
And I'm Tom Plotkin. Present affiliations include working with the College Promise campaign that's working to eliminate tuition at public colleges, and Foundation Maison Sciences de l'Homme, a foundation based in France that's working on what they call the Neat Transform project, a pan-European Erasmus-funded project to modernize Europe's higher education institutions in the context of digital technologies. You'll hear more from me.
I'm Willem van Wachtenberg. I work at Delft University of Technology in the Netherlands, and I'm there responsible for all open education initiatives at the university, and I'm president of the Open Education Foundation.
Hi everyone, I'm Angela Hoffman. I'm Angela DeBarge, Program Officer at Tulip Foundation. I'm really excited to be part of these conversations, particularly because we're in the midst of a strategy refresh from the work in open education and trying to better understand how to deepen those connections with our work in open education and teaching and learning. So.
Hi, everybody. My name is Cable Green. I'm the Director of Open Education at Creative Commons and recently the interim CEO at Creative Commons as well. I'm new to the group. Thanks for the invitation. I did put my vision statement online because Peter said I couldn't have crab cakes and wasn't I did. So I won't read it to you. I'll let you look at it. I'll just call out one thing. I'm particularly interested in solving inefficiencies in the existing system of public investment in education resources and in research. So I get, oftentimes I'm frustrated in conversations about sustainability because I think mostly we have the public money that we need. We're just really bad at how we spend it. And so I spend a lot of my time working with governments and systems of education, trying to convince them that the default on publicly funded resources ought to be open. As Nicole always says, and I completely agree with her, that's not the end. We do that as just the base so that we can do the important work on top of that. And I brought presents that I'll pass around, so you can take one and pass it.
Hi, everybody. I'm Brianna Schofield. I'm the Executive Director of Authors Alliance. We represent authors who are motivated by sharing their work of authorship broadly. And we do that by creating educational resources and tools to help authors understand their options for reaching readers that aren't necessarily the default of copyright. And we do some policy advocacy as well to that aim in an effort to promote sound copyright policies for authors who have those interests. Thank you.
I'm Mark O'Brien. I'm from State University of New York System. I oversee the Library of the Office of Library and Information Services, plus the open education space that we're kind of investing in SUNY, an area called the SUNY OER Services, plus we're looking to stand up another shared service for open access here in the new future and the near future. So what SUNY is interested in is how OER plays in the teaching and learning space. We really don't see open as the vehicle to just make content open. We really see it transforming the way our faculty are approaching teaching. We're curious to know what that impact looks like in the open access space. Opening up research and opening up data, I think that's invaluable, but I don't really know what that means yet for our public university system. We have some faculty that play in that space, but honestly, it's relatively new for our campuses. The more I talk to them, the more I realize most do not know what open access is. So I sat down next to Brianna, and we're going to relocate you to New York State, where you are going to launch a major education.
Hi, everybody. I'm Sharon Liu from the Department of Education. Thank you for inviting me here. I work in a group called the Office of Educational Technology, and our goal is to leverage technology to provide education for all students. So we've been interested in open education for a while. We spend your public money, whether good or bad. I'm excited to hear you say, MJ and many others, that free is good as sort of a baseline and a good step, but that there are tremendous opportunities here with how we can think about teaching and learning and think about content and creating engaging experiences for more students. So thanks. And also, I didn't write it anything on the like document, but I feel like I really want to come to dinner anyway. So.
I owe Sharon a crab cake. I owe Sharon like three crab cakes. She can have mine.
You can have one of mine.
She can definitely have mine.
Hi there, I'm Norman Beer. I'm at Carnegie Mellon University where I lead the Open Learning Initiative. I'm new to the group, so thank you for the invitation. I did manage to sneak my vision statement in at the absolute last moment, promise of crab cakes. But I think that one of the things that OLI has been focusing on for almost two decades now is the capabilities of Open to deliver better, more robust learning, not just within the immediacy of the OER that we're developing, but also in helping us to understand how human beings learn. I'm really excited about the capability of Open to deliver that, both from materials and from open practice. and I think that we're at a pretty pivotal time in terms of our opportunities to take better advantage of the resources, but also better advantage of the software, the data that we're generating, and come together in ways that really can drive better learning for our students.
Hey, everybody. James Glossop-Oslag with College of the Canyons in California, which is one of the 1,100 community colleges in the U.S., one of the 114 in California. At College of the Canyons, I'm an academic dean over libraries, tutoring, academic support, online, that kind of stuff, and OER falls into that. And for the past couple of years, I've been coordinating a project in the California Community Colleges to help some of our schools develop Z degrees, or we call them zero textbook cost degrees, and we've seen terrific success, not only for our students, but also in terms of penetrating the conversations at the institutions around reducing equity gaps, around creating pathways for students, getting open into strategic plans and funding processes as well. So that's been really exciting. Before I did that, I was president of the Open Education Consortium and a bunch of other kinds of things like that. So glad to be here.
Hi, everybody. I'm Deb Adair. I'm the executive director of Quality Matters, and I'm also new. This is my first time at Open 2020. I'm not new to the conversations around Open. So Quality Matters has started out with focusing on quality assurance for online education, and now we're focusing on online and digitally enhanced and trying to broaden that. And we have been over the years, let me just back up and say we work, speaking of boots on the ground, we work with faculty, we work with instructional designers, and the first level administrators at the institutions to do this work. And we work with 1,200 institutions, mostly in the U.S., some of them overseas. And over the years, and this is ramping up, we are getting asked over and over again to become involved in the OER initiative. And I think the cursory ask is about there should be standards. And, of course, that's not we don't think that we would best serve the community by doing that. But I think that there are larger issues, and I will go back and add my vision. I big picture vision of what open education could be is, and being the norm, I think, is the vision. I have worries. I have, I have some thoughts about what the guardrails really, we need to be thinking about guardrails here, too. And, you know, it's the kind of philosophy, if this is everybody's responsibility, does it end up being nobody's responsibility? And so those are the kinds of things that I'm thinking about, but I won't sneak them into the vision. I'll keep it at the high level.
Hi, everyone. I'm Richard Sebastian. I am the director of the OER Degree Initiative at Achieving the Dream. This is my first meeting, so thanks for the invitation. The OER Degree Initiative is coming to an end. It was around a three-year initiative. We worked with 38 community colleges to develop full degree pathways using open educational resources, both for affordability. Also, the degree pathway offered a mechanism for something that we really are involved in, which is institutional transformation. So it's not just siloed efforts happening, but actually you get the institution involved in creating these pathways and see some kind of deeper, more entrenched change, which I think we have seen from our colleges. That has led to AT's work and focus on OER around teaching and learning, kind of echoing what some others have said of being a mechanism for really helping community colleges support faculty, prepare faculty to not only create and adopt OER, but how do you effectively use it in the classroom to engage students, to address equity issues. It's a really important part of this. And so our work around OER is, at the moment, kind of focused around using it in the context of the community college classroom.
I'm Annika Manny. I'm a principal at Everidge Partners. We're a consulting firm based in New York, and I'm here supporting our favorite client, University System of Maryland, the Kerwin Center. We provide consulting services in terms of strategy, implementation, project management, logistics. So we helped with the hosting of this event today with our partners at MIT, and also be taking notes today.
Nicole Allen, Director of Open Education with SPARC, which represents academic and research libraries working to make open the default in research and education. 13 years ago, I was a recent college graduate frustrated with the high cost of textbooks, and I've been working ever since then to advocate for open educational resources, first working with students and lately working with libraries. I do a lot of work at the policy level, also helping to develop new leaders in the library space. I don't think I ever posted my mission statement, but that was your mistake feeding us dinner before. And also, you can't bribe me with cupcakes because I'm a vegetarian. But thrilled to be here. I'll be back.
Peter Kaufman from MIT Open Learning, where I work closely with Kurt, and also MIT's new Knowledge Futures Group, where I work closely with Amy. I'm thrilled that everyone can make it. We're deeply grateful for all the people who traveled so far, especially the next third meeting of this will be in California. So that makes it easier for the California West Coast people who came, and maybe harder, sorry. But it's going to be fun because it'll be cold here soon and it's warm there. So thank you again very much for coming.
We have a few people on the phone, too.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So, Ross, hopefully you guys can hear us better, too. They moved you into the middle of the room.
Yeah, we can hear you well. So my name's Ross Mounts. I'm the Director of Open Access Programs at Arcadia. It's fascinating to have so many of my grantees in the same room, and I'm sad I'm not there.
We're sorry you couldn't join us as well. Yvonne?
Hey, folks. It's Yvonne Ng from MIT Open Learning. Thanks you to everybody who's been so responsive on email. I'm helping with logistics, and I'm glad that you guys have all enjoyed a lovely lunch.
Thanks, Yvonne. Is Jeff on the phone?
Yes, I am. Jeff Yvoyes with Love for Change, longtime open access advocate. With an organization affiliated with the MacArthur Foundation called Love for Change that is trying to make open data more of a norm in philanthropy. I'm in kind of a noisy environment, so I'm going to spare you by hitting mute again.
Thanks. And is Philip on the phone? No. How about Hunt? Anybody else we missed? Okay. Sorry to interrupt, Peter. Go ahead.
I know that I used to work at Columbia's Center for Teaching and Learning. I'm a native New Yorker. And in New York, we used to say that the most dangerous place to stand for anyone was between Chuck Schumer and a television camera. and that still holds today. But I'm very conscious of the fact that Kurt and I are standing between you and Hal Plotkin's interventions, which are forthcoming. And it's a special pleasure, Hal, to have you travel all this way to incite us. What should we do?
You can stop right there.
No. I'm not having that. Come on. Yeah, what should we do? I want to say that... it would be bad. Crab cakes ain't nothing. The penalties for leaving tomorrow without a list of real deliverables for this group. We shouldn't let that happen. So I know we have a wiki that's got the agenda, that's got the vision statements, that has the notes from the last meeting, and has a number of other things. We've begun a Google Doc that we'd like to put up at some point today on the board of a list of, say, 20 deliverables that Kurt and I know have been noodling on a bit that are across the board, print, video, wiki, a meeting here, a performance art piece, a sculpture garden, but all related to the future of open for me, what matters the most is this kind of conversation we've inaugurated around truth and trust, and what the Rand Corporation has called our situation of truth decay. I think there's a, perhaps a, also moral, ethical responsibility to universities, educators, knowledge institutions to participate in the struggle toward facts or toward evidence-based knowledge online. And I think that it relates very closely to some of the core missions that we've been working on for 10, 15, 20, years, and I think the pressure to act has only increased in recent. I probably should have a count of days since January 8th, 2000, whatever that inauguration day was. But ladies and gentlemen, Hal Plotkin.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Let me. I hope you don't mind if I. Take the Ukrainian. I'm actually Ukrainian by background, so so I'm more comfortable here, and also more comfortable standing up if I can. That way I can see you all, and I can. I tend to speak aerobically, and it will help me to do so. And I've also set my timer here because, like in the Ukrainian Politico, I'm apt to keep you here all day. Unless I have something beeping to keep me on track and to keep our meeting on track. But I want to thank MJ and Peter and the organizers of this meeting for giving me the gift of this very important real estate, which I know I'm taking up on the agenda and which I know that everyone around the table could easily also assume with content and input that would be extraordinarily valuable. For me, this is a very kind, personally kind, opportunity. Just parenthetically, as I start out, I've had a very difficult personal year. And so if I get a little bit, please forgive me if I get a little overwrought in part of my remarks today, part of it's just being a little bit more closer to my emotional edges than normal. We've just come out of a horrendous health episode in my family. In a bizarre coincidence of fate, my wife, Lauren, my beloved wife of 25 years, and Cable both had liver transplants the exact same week. And then during the period when Cable had sworn most everybody he knew to secrecy about his health condition, he and I were rapidly exchanging notes about treatment modalities and centers and all the rest. And then through an extraordinary coincidence, my wife's life was saved in the same week that Cable's life was saved. And that kind of put me out of the loop, professional loop. I was a full-time caregiver for most of the last year. This is my first trip outside of California in about a year and a half. I made my first real trip just about a week and a half ago to visit James and his colleagues to congratulate their progress on his ETC. So I just want to begin by sort of putting on the table the mental frame of reference that I carry, as which may explain some of the tenor of some of my remarks. During most of the last year and a half, of course, I've been, you know, sitting by my wife's bedside, working Twitter as hard as I could to support many of your efforts and to encourage and cheer you on. But I'd be remiss if I didn't begin with just a and I could speak about most of you and my deep affection and respect and appreciation for the work that each of you have been doing. I know some of you better than others and others less well. I think first, of course, because of this remarkable bond we share both as professional colleagues and as sufferers in different contexts, but it's remarkable that Cable is here today. My wife is still home on a feeding tube and with 24/7 nurses. And Cable's extraordinary courage and determination. And Cable, we love you, and we are so grateful for the strength and leadership that you've exhibited on our behalf all of these years, the walls you've knocked down here in the United States and around the world, and the difference that you've made. And may you continue to heal and take it easy, and don't push yourself so hard, and know that you carry with you our respect and affection and highest esteem. So we love you, Cable.
So much.
Thanks, Al.
I also just I have to quickly acknowledge a couple of other people to whom I have around the table to have an enormous personal debt. And let me just thank Sharon Liu. Many people thought when the Trump administration came in that it would mean the end of the federal government's constructive participation in the open education resources field. And Sharon has played a key role in using her remarkable diplomatic skills, her intelligence, her savvy about how government works, to find a way through the thicket and maintain forward progress at the federal level in the most difficult of circumstances. So, Sharon, I try not to say too many good things about you in public in your own best interests. since we're here among friends, please know that you have my everlasting respect and appreciation for the work that you continue to do on our behalf. And I could say similar things around it. It's such a joy always to see Nicole. I've loved over the last year and a half, as I've felt sort of out of the loop and haven't been able to contribute as much. And Nicole, who I met as a student organizer 15, 18 years ago, applying for her first Hewlett grant, and then watching her take a position of global leadership that has moved so many important initiatives and developed so many new initiatives that have impacted our area. I'll stop there, but please imagine all of the good things. Peter and I have so much work yet to do together. And Peter's groundbreaking meeting at Columbia 15, 18 years ago, where he spoke so eloquently in a way that sort of established the work plan for many of us, that we went home from Peter's meeting where we had a five-year to-do list because of the charge that he made to us at that extraordinarily important meeting early on, and to know that I'm still his colleague and I have an opportunity to work with him personally. Let me move on to what I have to say today. I apologize, because of the circumstances, I wasn't able to prepare slides to illustrate my talk. If I had more time, I might have come up with the kind of fancy slides and multimedia presentation that Cable and Nicole and others around the room are so good at. But this is a very unique group, and although I've done some speaking in the last couple of weeks, mostly to faculty groups who are new to open educational resources, some of our core leadership, and so it requires a completely different topic and a completely different approach to the talk. And while I haven't had a chance to prepare slides, I do have a very clear idea of what I want to accomplish today in the 22 minutes that are available to me, I think it is, so this keeps the 23, oh my goodness. And the talk, I've sort of divided it into a beginning, a middle, and an end. And I want to, in the beginning, review from you, because some of you were there, but most of you weren't, how this whole OER thing got started. Because it's very important when you're thinking about where you can go and where you should go to remember how you got here. And some of you were not part of that and don't know the sort of origin stories of all this, how this all got off the ground. And then in the middle, I want to talk about where we are now, at least where I think we are now, the pluses and the minuses. And then at the end, I want to talk about where we need to go. Because one of the reasons that I'm here, I wouldn't normally be here. Like I said, I left my wife with 24-hour nursing services. I'm Jewish. Today happens to be Rosh Hashanah, one of the holiest days of the year. Normally, I'd be in the synagogue praying. My daughter is singing in the choir today. But when I got this invitation and I saw who would be here, it filled my heart with the knowledge that I might have a chance to have some impact, to continue to have some influence. And for me, this opportunity is as close to praying as I get, as it gets, because this is what I pray about. And this is the work that's closest to my heart. I spent 25 years as a journalist before sort of falling into OER work 20 years ago or so. But it's my association with the open education community and my work on OER that's been the proudest part of my life and career and my greatest source of personal satisfaction. So the chance to be here with you is, in some sense, an answer to my prayers. And an answer to what I've been thinking about as I've been sitting by my wife's bedside all this time. Let me tell you quickly about how I first got involved in the OER movement. Not because I'm so great, it's a quirky little story, but also just because it sort of establishes the bona fides for the key messages that I want to share with you today. Because I come to you also desperately worried. I think in our OER movement at this point in time, it's my assessment that we are sort of at the end of the beginning. And I'm desperately worried that it's also going to be the beginning of the end. And there are some real reasons why I think that's true. And I need to get those out on the table and off my heart. In my 25 years history as a journalist, I happen to have grown up in what my family moved to. It was called the Valley of the Heart's Delight. It later became known as Silicon Valley. And I was interested in journalism as a young person, and so I started writing for different newspapers and publications and hosting radio programs locally and things like that. And just because it was what was in the air around then, a lot of my earliest stories were all of these stories about new companies that nobody had ever heard of. Like I wrote the first internationally published story about a company called Cisco Systems when it had like 14 employees and they just acquired the rights to the router from Stanford University. And they thought its main application was going to be preventing check kiting by tying databases from banks together. And I wrote the first story about Yahoo and then went on to help start Marketplace on the public radio network, which is still there. And a lot of journalistic outfits became interested in what was going on in Silicon Valley, and I had created a little cottage industry as a Silicon Valley correspondent. At one point, I was the Silicon Valley correspondent for 8 different magazines. They were all too cheap to have an office, but they all used my mailing address and put me on their masthead. And then I went to work for CNBC as their Silicon Valley correspondent and was writing a column for the San Francisco Chronicle as well. And I began to get guilt pangs about 20 years ago because the first stories that I wrote about technology, digital technology, are what I might call techno-utopian. The people who were involved in the homebrew computer club that I covered, Dr. Dobbs Journal, Jim Warren, the first computer fair that I covered, there was the sentiment, which I naively reported, that these new technologies were going to be socially constructed. The first story I ever wrote about digital technology was all about what it was going to do for education and how it was going to make it possible for people to get access to education that had been heretofore undreamed of. And then I watched as the early applications of technology were reinforcing the powerful at the expense of the powerless. And I should have known better. I realized early on, 20 years ago, I should have known better. Because as I reflected on it, that's the history of all the diffusion of how tools work throughout all of human history. Whenever a new tool is developed, it's always the powerful who wield the power of that tool to protect their positions and to subjugate others. Undoubtedly, the first well that was ever dug was originally seized by some strongman, who would extort people to get access to it until finally the villagers gathered together and clubbed them over the head and made it into a public resource. The first chariots, the peasants didn't have the first chariots. Originally television was only for rich people, and the power of new tools and new technologies takes some while for it to trickle into the, if it ever does, into the hands of the powerless, but it's almost uniformly wielded by the powerful against the powerless. And I felt profoundly guilty about having passed on naively some of those first stories that I wrote about how something inherent in digital technologies was going to be humanistically oriented. So I started writing columns for the San Francisco Chronicle about, at the time, what I was calling, this is in the 1990s, public domain learning materials, prior to OER. And the suggestion that I was making was that the inherent in these technologies are capacities that are not being used, and that we needed better sets of public policies and better approaches to make sure that the capacities of the technologies that were being used were actually being used in ways that would benefit the public, and in particularly the least among us. And so I was writing those columns for the San Francisco Chronicle. One day, I got a call from somebody, I don't even remember who it was, who wanted to have coffee with me in the local coffee shop to talk about something that had been in one of my columns. And I'm sitting there in the Palo Alto Printers, Inc. coffee shop, talking too loudly, as is my wont, you know, waving, gesticulating, all of the rest, when a woman comes and taps me on my shoulder from across the room. I thought she was going to ask me to, you know, keep it down, please. They're trying to get some work done. It turned out to be Lisa Ryan, and she said, "I'm sorry, sir. I couldn't help but hearing what you were saying, and I wanted to know, she said, I'm working as a research assistant to a professor at Stanford named Larry Lessig, and he's been thinking and talking about a lot of the same things, too, and he's starting to develop a new venture, and I just wonder if he could talk to you. You might be interested in talking to him. Here's my number." We exchanged numbers. The next thing led to a phone call, and Larry and I were on the phone. Larry had read some of my columns, and he started to talk to me about this idea he had for something called Creative Commons. I thought it would make a wonderful column for me to write about. And originally, and I peppered Larry with lots and lots of questions, went to visit him. Larry introduced me to Aaron, his chief technologist, 15-year-old boy who was barely shaving, his chief technologist, right? And the two of them sat me down and talked to me about what they thought they were going to do with Creative Commons and how it might work. I asked Larry if I could write about it. He said no. At the time, he was afraid that if I wrote about it, somebody might steal the idea. They hadn't launched it yet. It was still at least a year away from being launched. And I went home. I thought about it all. And then I just sent Larry a memo with a bunch of questions of, you know, how would this work? How would that work? What would this be application? And then he called me up and he said, "You know, I think this is going to be a more difficult, given your questions, I think this is going to be a more difficult project than I imagined." And he encouraged me to go ahead and write a column about it, about the idea, which he thought might be useful in helping him wrestle some money to get the idea off the ground. At the time, he was just negotiating and had just met Mike Smith at the Hewlett Foundation for what later became the foundational grant. So I wrote the first thing that was ever published about Creative Commons as an idea a year before the organization issued its first licenses. And then I started, Larry's an easy guy to get to be a friend with, and I started looking for ways to help. So I tell you that story, again, not because I'm important, just because talk loud when you're in a coffee shop. Life is the quirkiest thing, and the way that our lives change on a twist of fate that you can't anticipate or plan is something that always boggles the mind. And I also tell you that story because it helps me illuminate what I'm going to tell you next. The first thing that happened after I wrote that first story, of course, is my wife saw a little notice in the local newspaper that the Hewlett Foundation had just started a new program led by Mike Smith about technology and justice and things that interested me. My wife clipped it and said, "You know, you should call these people up and make sure they're reading your articles." So I sent Kathy Casserly, who I tracked down on the web, an email, and I sent her some of my articles. Next thing, the phone rings, "Can you be here tomorrow?" And Kathy invited me in, and they were just starting the program then, and within a day, she had offered me the first contract with the Hewlett Foundation, one of dozens that I had, either grants or contracts, over the ensuing 15 years. The first thing that she hired me to do on a $20,000 contract at the time was, "We need you to consult with a bunch of other people. Here's the list. We need a definition of OER, of open education." So the term had just been coined at UNESCO meeting a few months earlier, but nobody really knew what it meant and how would we define it. So when you hear people talk about the Hewlett definition of open educational resources, that was my first project with working with Kathy and our colleagues. So what I now realize, now fast forwarding all these years, and part of my concern that brings me here to you at this time, is that I now realize that I was witness to the equivalent of the positive equivalent of what might be called the black swan event in philanthropy. You know what a black swan event is? Typically, a black swan event is something like the meteor that crashed into the Yucatan Peninsula, or the stock market crash in 1929 or something like that. Some big thing that only happens once an epoch and that never repeats, but that has an extraordinary impact. Except in the case of Mike and Kathy at the Hewlett Foundation, maybe I should call it a purple swan event because it had a positive impact. But when you look back at what Mike and Kathy did in those early years, and arguably what they did is the reason all of us are here today, and all of us, is they invested in the creation of Creative Commons. Nothing like it had ever existed before. There was copyright or no copyright, but the Creative Commons idea was completely new and unprecedented. They invested in the MIT Open Courseware Project, where they had been invited to support a group of faculty led by Hal Abelson and others there that wanted to do the revolutionary thing of putting all of their learning resources online. They invested in CMU OOI, the revolutionary idea that maybe these digital technologies could be used to accelerate learning in new ways that would be scalable to populations previously unreached. Nobody had ever done such a thing in the context of the recursive feedback loops that the CMU LLI team was preparing. So, and a series of others. They invested in a wild dreamer named Peter Kaufman, who had an architecture for thinking in different ways about how media could be repurposed for public policy. They invested in an organizing campaign led by the student PERGs. First time, to my knowledge, that the foundation had ever done such a thing, invested in student organizers to advocate for information justice. Where was the evidence that any of these interventions would work? There was none. There was none. Where was the business plans that would show? Where were the revenue generation plans? Where were the sustainability plans? Where was any of none? Nothing. And somehow, Mike and Kathy, instead they developed what they called a logic model, as I remember. Some of you may have filled it out. They wanted to know, at the time, how, if what you were proposing would work, why it might matter, and what it might accomplish. And they were willing to fail, and fail publicly. You know, Mike didn't care. Mike had been a dean of education at Harvard. He'd been an undersecretary of education. He wasn't worried about his next job, he just wanted to make as big an impact as he could in the time he had with the resources he had. So the reason I point out that, the reason I call it a purple swan event is as I meet, as I have been able to in the last couple of years with foundation officials, and the major funders, both public and private, for endeavors like ours, it seems to me that they've mostly reverted to the mean of where most philanthropists were, and certainly where most government officials were. And in some cases, they've even become mean in that they have adopted the wholly impractical and unhelpful meme, M-E-M-E, put out by well-meaning people like Pierre Omidyar, for example, who are asserting that what they need to invest in are things that look like what appeals to venture capitalists, the venture model of philanthropy, that, we need a business plan, we need a sustainability plan, we need a revenue model, all of these kind of things that you typically hear from venture capitalists and which has infected our philanthropic community in a way that I think has been destructive, because in many cases what it's done is it's shorn the public interest, the pursuit of the public interest, the unbridled pursuit of the public interest, from the decisions that are made about trying new things that may not have any of the attributes of a well-honed business plan that a venture capitalist would recognize and respond to. That's my summary of the beginning, is that we're here because of a purple swan event. because a handful of philanthropists were willing to do things that virtually no philanthropists would entertain today. To try things that are entirely new, had never been done before, for which there was no evidence it might work, and who were willing to fail. And then when they failed, to learn from those failures, and then scrape up what was left and figure out, okay, well, it didn't work this way, and it didn't work this way, and it didn't work, maybe it'll work this way. And iteratively iterate themselves to the kind of global impact that we've been able to have at this time. Fast forward to the present day of where we are. As a group, you have achieved more than those of us who were there at the beginnings would have ever dreamed possible. You are and have put more progress on the map that if you had told us then what we know now, that open textbooks have saved students $1 billion or more that we can calculate because of the few million dollars that these brave philanthropists put into these ventures at the time, creating a multiplier effect for philanthropy that is unmatched in any other intervention that I'm aware of. I don't know of any other single philanthropic intervention, from the Gates Foundation to the Ford Foundation to the Rockefeller Foundation to the MacArthur Foundation, that has created a larger multiplier effect in terms of the amount of money that went in and the direct amount of easily measurable money that most of our most needy and deserving people around the world have benefited from. So that's been extraordinary progress. There's some other progress that I don't think even you know about or are yet to claim. One of my biggest frustrations in working in the Obama administration was that I could never once get President Obama to say the words open educational resources. You look back at the public, even though he presided over the largest public expenditure in open educational resources that had ever been made any place around the world, $2 billion through the job training programs that was where Sharon and I worked on developing and where that was a requirement. And at least a dozen times, and I'm giving you inside scoop here, but you can report it. I've talked about it before. At least a dozen times when I was called on to write speeches or passages of speeches for President Obama during my service there, and he wanted to talk about what they were doing in education, I would write explain what we were doing with open educational resources. And every single time, those words were edited out. And in their place, routinely, the president's chief of staff or senior speechwriters would substitute the words online education. Right? And I fought and protested and kicked up my heels and went to the White House 100 times to try and I got all kinds of pushback. People won't know what we're talking about. With the president says open education, they won't know what that means. They would say, well, people understand online education, so we're going to talk about that. Well, that's not what they need. It's not what you should be using. So President Obama never talked about his most significant accomplishment. And yet, during the time of your work and our work together, I would argue to you that the work we did in open education resources and the concurrent availability of other types of quasi-open resources that are used for education, for example, YouTube and all the instructional videos that are there, they are what is responsible for the global economic recovery we are enjoying right now. Now, that may sound wild and crazy, but and let me find my notes on this, because the president, this is not, if you go up to 100 people on the street and ask them what are open educational resources, you'd be lucky to find one who knows what it is. And if you ask 1,000 people what has been the economic impact of open educational resources, you'd be lucky to find one in 10,000 who could draw the linkage. But what we know from really well-done studies by the World Bank is that that for every year of educational attainment that you increase among a population worldwide, you increase the income by 10 to 20% for girls and 5 to 15% for boys. So the we are responsible for the largest increase in access to education and practical job training opportunities that's ever existed in the world. That's what's taken place on our watch, is more access to life-changing educational and job training resources for more people at prices that they can afford. And it's afforded no credit whatsoever for the fact that concurrent with the delivery of those educational resources, a global economic demand started to grow again. You might think that my claiming credit for the global economic recovery and growth is tied to the work we've done in making more educational resources readily available around the world. You may think that's crazy. I think it's crazier to attribute the economic recovery to anything President Trump has done. That's who is claiming credit, shamelessly, for the resurgence in global economic growth that we've experienced over the last few years. And I would put it to you that any contributions he's made has been on the other side. But that what we have done, beyond these savings for students and putting money back in their pockets, is that we have saved the world's economy by creating conditions that have allowed for the resumption of economic growth, because the growth of the economy depends on demand. And when people have nothing, they can't demand anything. And now I want to get to the end. And with your permission, can I go 5 minutes over? The beginning, how we got here, Purple Swan event in philanthropy. Worried that we'll never see that again. The middle, accomplishments more significant than you or we even realize or claim credit for. Now, why do I worry that this is the beginning of the end? At the beginning, when I first started to write about all of this stuff, I got taken out to lunch by a headhunter, a recruiter for David Wiley, the textbook publisher. And they had misunderstood some of what I...
John Wiley.
David Wiley's archive. John Wiley, pardon me, trying to race through this.
No.
And the Wiley vice president took me out and was trying to recruit me for a job. They wanted me to be their regional representative to colleges and universities in the area. And he was telling me, this is 20 years ago, why they were so excited about digital technologies and what it would mean to their industry, why they could offer me, at that time, like a $200,000 salary 20 years ago, and with bonuses and the rest. And he said, well, we're really excited about these digital technologies. Well, yes, I don't know. And he said, we're really excited about these digital technologies because it means that for the first time we're going to be able to make sure that every student pays full price every time. And here I was, said we're going to be able to wipe out the market for used textbooks. And he even told me at the time that they had a scheme for metering student use of learning materials, so they could charge students by the hour, depending on how long they looked at the materials. Remember him telling me, he said, look, in every other industry, that's how it works. If you take your car to a mechanic and he spends 2 hours working, that's how much you pay him. And so we can do the same thing. And I left there so alarmed. Every student could pay full price every time. Last year, here's why I'm worried about the future. And here's why I think we need to move past where we are with a kind of rate change leap step that's more emblematic of the kinds of approaches that we saw in the Purple Swan era of Mike Smith and Kathy Casserly. I went to the ASU-GSV meeting. And I was down there for a day. And I snuck into the sessions led by Pearson and Cengage and McGraw-Hill. And they all were talking about the same thing. And the mantra that they were using, which is the equivalent of every student pays full price every time, was that they were working on a new technical architecture where the assessments would become the course, where they would be able to, using digital technologies, create online assessments that were so deeply and thoroughly embedded into the course that they would be inextricable from the content.
and they would be so time-saving for faculty members who would then be relieved of the obligations of having to prepare tests, change the questions, change the answers, hide the questions, hide the answers, do all of that kind of nonsense, that they would become unstoppable in the marketplace. And I walked out of there realizing that if their vision succeeds, OER content will be left in the dust as an irrelevant artifact of an idealistic urge that's been supplanted by the next generation of commercial technologies. And so that's why my appeal to you, to each of you, is to begin, and some of you already have, and some of you already have begun laying the groundwork for this, for example, with the Open Syllabus Project, which creates a set of resources that we can think about applying to the creation of open assessments. And that would be my big pitch, is that we need to move past open content and move to, what do I mean by open assessments? Think flight simulator. When the U.S. military needs to train a new jet pilot or a cybersecurity expert or a trauma surgeon, they don't put her in front of a bubble test and if she gets 83%, give her that responsibility. They put her in a simulator. I've seen how these operate at the Department of Defense. And they throw all kinds of adverse circumstances at the person. And if they can land the plane on the tarmac, five times out of five, then they give her the keys to the $300 million jet. There's a huge appetite. I work for this foundation part-time in Europe. There's a huge interest in Europe right now in the development of open assessments, including for transcript college course credit, because they solve a course articulation problem. As those of you in higher education governance, one of the difficulties that we have impeding collaboration and progress is this need that we have to articulate course credit from college to college. Usually these are boutique arrangements between each college and another. They're very hard to negotiate. They're very cumbersome. Imagine if commerce worked that way. Imagine if every commercial transaction between international buyers and sellers had to begin with them negotiating their own individual currency exchange rate. What would that do to the flow of goods and services across borders and cultures? Obviously, it would impede it. But if we can begin to articulate college course credits across borders and cultures by use of open assessments that are like a flight simulator for algebra, a flight simulator for organic chemistry, and where those simulated assessments are robust and reliable, as is with technically within our reach, and freely available, we could make a world possible where anyone, could rise academically from anywhere, fulfilling the original goals of our open educational resources movement. Our movement was not about open licenses. Our movement was not about open content. When our movements got started, Larry Lessig, I remember if you go back and read the first article I wrote about it, Larry didn't even anticipate OER at the time. He thought he was building a licensing system where companies could park computer code that they no longer needed for public use by others. It was intended originally to be a code repository of unused computer code. It was only when people like David Wiley and others in this room started applying it for educational purposes that the OER revolution became possible. So I think for the reasons that I outline, including the fact that we have willing and able and interested partners in Europe who are eager to see this kind of progress take place, that we need to as rapidly shift our focus from open content toward open assessments as we can, because we need to play chess and not checkers. And then because we're up against proprietary adversaries who are playing chess and who are thinking about and developing these products and services. The last thing I want to put on our map is where I think we need to go with public policies. And some of it's been alluded to here. But in the realm of public policy, there are opportunities that have gone untapped. And again, they require a purple swan backer, because they've never been done before. And we're not scaling something that works or replicating a model that's proven. But we need lasting public support for an organization like Creative Commons that doesn't depend on rattling a tin cup from time to time and hoping a philanthropist will be generous in seeing it. Where is the place to get that? I contend the place to get that is by an amendment to the structure of the U.S. Copyright Office. When somebody files for a copyright, 10% of the money that they spend for their copyright fee ought to go into a public fund whose job it is to support an organization that protects, defends, and develops public licenses for the public use of information. If you read the copyright clause in the Constitution, it says it's there to protect and extend the life of science and the arts. And at the time, strict copyright was the best way to do that, but now there are other ways to extend and protect the life of the science, the viability of the science and the arts. And we need to build into public law the support for the public commons so that we don't operate outside as kind of a rump action. We also need to embed in our higher education institutions requirements that they support educators who are using or creating or repurposing open educational resources. More and more colleges have begun to take on people who have these responsibilities or take on people who then identify these responsibilities as being, but we ought to make it a requirement that if you want to receive Title IV funding from the federal government, that your college has a program in place to support faculty members who are interested in open educational resources and that you ought to be required to report publicly at least once a year on the extent of the support that you are providing those faculty members. Just like the federal government required some years ago that every college has to have, if you want to receive Title IV funds, you have to have a policy in place to protect faculty and students against sexual harassment. Those sexual harassment policies, which now exist all over, they didn't happen all by themselves. They were going to lose their funding unless they opened up an avenue for people who have been sexually harassed to pursue their complaints. We need to do the same thing with open educational resources. Apologize for taking too much more time, but let me just conclude here. I've had, over the last 20 years, the greatest ride that anybody can have in their professional life by being part of this community and getting to know many of you and working on projects with many of you. Personally, all my dreams have come true. I got a chance to be a presidential appointee in the administration of Barack Obama directly because of the work that I was doing in this area. And from time to time because of that, because of the mostly undeserved honors and accolades that I've been privileged to win over the years because of this work, people come up to me from time to time and they tell me that they feel cheated in their own careers, that they sometimes feel like they could have been more than they were or more than they've been. They could have been better known or they could have had an opportunity to serve in a presidential administration or to influence state policies in one way or another or to be responsible for new legislation, but they were just never in the right place at the right time. You know, it was just bad luck. And so if you remember anything from this long-winded charge that I'm trying to give you here today, I hope you'll remember this. And it's that this is the right time. This is the right place. And you are the right people. Thank you for your attention.
I love the description that Hal gave of his talking style as aerobic. I think that's tremendous. I make sure, if you can, that your notes get to Annika because that was fast and rich. And we should probably just end the meeting and all go home after such a thing. But it's incredibly stimulating to think. First of all, I'm Ukrainian, too, partly, and Jewish, and I like five-year plans, like the next guy. But we have, in front of us is the kind of, what is it, What's May of 2020? 7 month plan, maybe 7 months to determine what's best for our working group to deliver. And it might be that the work of this group continues as it's bound to in various ways. Maybe this group will continue, who knows. But I think, Hal, you've really set us up on a journey intellectually, imaginatively, and an inspirational one with some depressing thoughts for us, too. I don't know, though, whether, you know, there are other philanthropies. I don't know if it's as bad as I tend to see a number of program officers at philanthropies, just to pick up on your point about the purple swan, you know, more sort of on the side of progressive action than ever. And it might be a function of the blank show that we're in today, or it might be a function of the sense that some of these people are working in the fields that we've been working in and feel stuff closing rather than opening and need to fight against it. I do know that at MIT there's a tremendous amount of activity around these questions that you're bringing up, Hal, of like open infrastructure and playing a major role. There are three meetings coming up. There's an October 21st meeting on the future of the Knowledge Futures Group and strategy session that Amy is running. There's a November 9th through 11th meeting on Wikipedia and credibility. There's a December 3rd meeting on spreading facts. And all of a sudden, now the university is hosting these conversations about infrastructure, responsibility in this wicked age that we find ourselves in, wicked from a political vantage point, wicked in part from the business platform and publishing vantage point. But I just am droning because how do that to me? What should we do next?
As Peter, you mentioned, we've been starting to sort of boil out from the discussions we had in the first meeting, plus ongoing conversations, some more specific thinking about exactly what kind of deliverables really make sense around this space. And
yeah,
I'd love to share some of that thinking and have some discussion with the group. But also kind of like to just pause for a moment and see if, you know, Hal's comments for anybody in the room have spurred any kind of new thinking about what a big, audacious, aspirational, you know, next purple swan type setup might be that's before us. You know, I think we've become really good at having a structured, organized progression on what OAR has become, but you know, what new disruptive, you know, sort of big things might be before us that we haven't thought of before.
Hal, if I may, I'd like to ask you to unpack a little bit more about what you mean by, I mean, I think I understand what you mean by open assessments, but and to preface that with the work that the Lumina Foundation has recently, well, they've been engaged in this for a long time, but in particular recently, Deborah Humphrey's framing of the quality equity conundrum, and, you know, their thinking around, and the work they've been supporting around trying to create better articulated competencies for doing exactly what you're talking about. So I'm right in the middle, right here in Maryland, right in the middle of all this articulation discussion, and looking at things like the comprehensive learner record and, you know, some of these other potential technologies that could help you and I to come to some agreement on what critical thinking means or what, you know, ability to titrate in chemistry, whatever the heck that is, means. And then for us to share that openly with each other in order to create these patterns.
Here's the pilot project I'd love to see you do, the Purple Swan pilot project.
I've begun ineptly to try and organize this myself. I'm probably not the right person to lead it, but maybe I can place it on the map. I'd love to see five colleges, and we already have five in Europe, five in the United States, and five in Latin America, come together to do a pilot for transcript credit open assessment. So say, for example, the five colleges come and it would be an open, online, dynamic, free assessment, and the five colleges in each of those three continents commit that if you pass that assessment under appropriate controlled circumstances, maybe, you know, with a proctor present three times out of three or something, you get transcript credit for, say, organic chemistry or physics. So that we can make it possible for anyone anywhere in the world to rise academically and for colleges to take their accomplishments seriously, to move in a purple swan-like fashion into the assessments arena, into the high-stakes assessment arena that involves a college like the University of Maryland or MIT or the Sorbonne, which is one of the people in Europe who've already agreed to do this, by the way. They have their own reasons. The French Polytechnics are on board to agree that if you pass this free and open assessment, we're going to give you some credits at our college. You would start at our college with some credits in your bank. If we can begin, and if we can pick the pilot project smartly, if we can illuminate the finishing line that demonstrates academic mastery in any particular subject or discipline, then we can create a really healthy competition among educational providers about who can help which group cross that finishing line most effectively. One of the big problems we have right now in higher education assessments is the boutique closed nature of it all, where there is no illuminated finishing line. Well, and then we tell students to run the race, but we're not going to tell you where the finishing line is. And you have no opportunity to get any academic credit if you do this. Now, we're benefiting, I contend, economically from the fact that we're even doing that, because we've increased the average educational attainment around the world measurably in ways that have had an economic impact. But if we could develop my dream would be to see an international consortium for open higher education assessments develop, and where some colleges would come together and agree to at least put a pilot project on the map that whose results they would accept for transcript credit. I think that would then establish a model that would do what we did in the early days of OER, which is to create this domino effect of people see this happen, and then they say, well, if you could do it there, we could do it here. And we begin to see and we would defend ourselves from the onslaught we're going to get from these commercial publishers whose mantra now is the assessment is the course. We need to make the assessment in OER the course. To stay competitive. Sorry to.
No, that's right. I think the vision is similar to what Lumina is talking about.
And I've been talking to them.
No, yeah. What worries me is, at least in the way you describe it, the binary nature of what you're discussing. That, you know, pass this and you get credit. Whereas if we could create assessments that are more diagnostic and help us understand where a particular learner is in the competencies, and then guide that learner toward additional things that they could be doing in order to get to that.
That would be a thing of beauty. That would be a thing of beauty.
That's where Lumina is.
But the thing to me is to, we don't have to change the whole world all at once. If we could just find, I think, five reputable colleges on three continents who agree to pilot one of these in some appropriate discipline, and to make it part of their core operations, that it's for real. You achieve this, you get credit on a transcript. You get, you know, Chem 1A or physics or geometry or whatever it is. That credit shows up on your transcript. And it shows up simultaneously on all of the transcripts of all 15 of the participating colleges. Because you imagine the kind of academic and scholarly energy we would unleash around the world. If a student in Sri Lanka knew that she could get credit on an MIT transcript tomorrow for passing a free open examination, I just think it would, you know, I'm looking for these kind of things that accelerate our progress into the more than just the incremental steps
that we found ourselves kind of repeating since the first big cataclysmic beginnings of our open universe.
So you asked what outcomes we might produce. So here's my proposal. I think this group and our colleagues who are not in the room, we largely know what to do. We know what winning looks like in open access. We know what winning looks like in open education. We could create those bold claims, be very detailed about each one. They're separate initiatives. Open education practices and open pedagogy is a different conversation than OER, is different than OA. They're all related, but they're distinct things. We could divide and lead and collaborate around those initiatives. This is something that most open movements and fields are really bad at. Right? We all, when we're in rooms like this, we all say, we should work together more, and then we tend not to. There's a bunch of structural reasons for that around funding, which I think we can get past. And it's just more work to collaborate, which frankly we need to get over because it's necessary to win. And then once we make those bold calls to action, this group and others, and we publish those, there's a call to action to the entire community around those focal points. And so when I say we know what to do, here are some examples of what I mean. With policy, with governments in particular, the right thing is that all publicly funded research and educational resources should either be put straight into the public domain or should have a CC BY license on them. There's a massive opportunity coming up with the UNESCO OER recommendation, which will be passed this November, starting Q1 of 2020. Ministries of Education around the world, the departments of Ed, are going to be ready for that conversation. That is one of the recommendations in the UNESCO document. Another policy point, which to me is a no-brainer, is that universities around the world and community colleges and technical colleges need to adjust their promotion and tenure so that OA and OER is valued as a plus and not a minus. Right now, it's a mixed bag. And we know that if we change the incentive structures for faculty, especially in promotion and tenure, they will respond to those incentives.
And the disciplinary organizations.
Absolutely. I was listening to the recording of your first meeting last night, and I heard people say over and over, the best science is created when it's OA and open data. Somebody went so far as to even say, you won't be able to participate in scientific activity if your content and your data is not available openly, and furthermore, if it's not available through a computer-accessible API. And so at CC, we've been talking about the reason that you need to have a CC BY license on your article and your data needs to be under CC0 is that people have to be able to text and data mine this stuff because that's the next wave of science. So we kind of know that. We also know, and Willem said at the last meeting, the best and most inclusive education happens when it's open because we can get those feedback loops of improving quality with each rep. One of my personal things, I think that one of the ways we solve the big challenges of the world, as indicated by the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, is to make all that stuff OER, right? If we want to provide access to not just some of the minds in the world, but all of the minds on how to get to zero poverty or clean water or gender equality or whatever your favorite SDG is, then we must meet that challenge by providing OER and OA research about every single one of those topics. Otherwise, we don't get to solve climate change and other challenges. We know that we have to provide training and mentorship to educators, librarians, lawyers, and many others. A lot of orgs are doing that. Creative Commons has launched its CC certificate program. Spark has a leadership training program. The Open Textbook Network has a librarian certificate. Authors Alliance, like their whole thing is about how do you educate authors about their rights so they don't give those rights away to publishers. And so there's that training aspect of it. And not just training people once they're out of the field, but getting this as curriculum into the colleges and universities so that as people are becoming lawyers, as they're becoming educators, as they're becoming librarians, that we actually teach them this early. We know that we are getting closer, but we have not yet built the critical mass of OER. So when we look at the long tail of the courses that are taught in higher education, we haven't yet filled out that fat part of the tail with OER. My estimates are that we probably need the top 100 to 150 highest enrolled courses. And the good news is that everybody teaches the same stuff. Right? We call it slightly different things. You might call it Chem 101. I might call it Introduction to Chemistry. But for the most part, the syllabi are very similar. Right? We know that we have challenges with articulation and transfer, not just within this country, but among countries. One of the things I've talked with UNESCO for years about is wouldn't it be interesting to have an international standards alignment tool that both would help people transfer credits, as there's multiple projects going on right now around the refugees as they leave Syria and other countries in the Middle East and they travel north. They're leaving as dentists and doctors, and when they get to Sweden or Germany, they're taxi drivers because their credentials have not transferred. But imagine also this database that knows what the math standards are in the Common Core in the United States, but they also know the math standards in South Africa and in Belgium and in Ghana. And if somebody in Ghana is looking for a piece of OER that aligns with their grade 6 standard, but nobody's built that OER in Ghana, they could go to this database and it would say, oh, your standard is the same as this one in Germany. Here's the content. And then other people have mentioned infrastructure. I don't have to get into that. But these are just a few examples where I think we know what we need to do. We're just really bad at getting organized, articulating it clearly, and then dividing and conquer and staying connected with each other around those common goals. I think that's the challenge in front of us.
Well, it sounds like you've begun sort of several years ago to answer that challenge, or maybe you just drafted that list this morning. But it would be good maybe if you, I don't know, is that a list that's fresh? Have you tried it out 100 times before? Is it something that you would want to lead the drafting of on behalf of our group, conceivably, on behalf of whatever it is? I mean, Hal was talking about raising my taxes, probably, because I sense the copyright fee that he's talking about, somehow my taxes are going to go up to fund Creative Commons. And until that time, I don't know, that tithing system that Hal you were speaking about, mm-hmm. like, it's such an interesting thing. Mm-hmm. That's like the BBC license fee.
Yeah.
In essence.
Yes. All of the things I endorse wholeheartedly, everything Cable just said, all of them need a sustainable revenue stream that needs to come, be publicly financed in some way.
Yeah.
So then we have to ask ourselves, where's the money going to come from? And right now, when people pay money to copyright something,
yeah.
if we just took 10% of that fee that they existingly, that they already pay, and put it into a fund that is designed to advance these public interest goals, including many of the things Cable just described, this articulation of academic standards across, well, that could be accomplished through an open assessment. That ought to be, that all of these ideas need to be funded. And my argument is that we cannot, as wonderful as the Hewlett Foundation has been to many of us over the years, we cannot architect a future that depends on philanthropy. We have to figure out how we transition these philanthropically supported endeavors into the heart of our governmental revenue generation and distribution models. And that's the task, is to who's the senator who's going to propose to create a public revenue stream to finance Cable's agenda? And how do we lobby and influence that person? I'm not interested in any more photo ops for politicians who want to stand up talking about how great it is that they support open textbooks. I want to know who's the politician that's going to create a sustainable revenue stream. Yeah, who's the politician that's going to create a sustainable revenue stream so that we can fund those efforts into perpetuity? And the Hewlett Foundation can move on to seed some other area. Create a sort of community that's dependent on philanthropy.
Sharon?
So I'm not a wet blanket all the time, I promise. I'm a very pragmatic individual, right? So I love all of the ideas that you proposed, Hal, but I guess from a engineering that future perspective, I feel like there are some pieces. And so I'm just going to, I'm not, asking you because I'm putting you on the spot. I actually think, for example, the 10% on the copyright fees is really interesting because it's not unprecedented, right? So we have H-1B visa fees.
Yes.
They're split between the Department of Labor and NSF for job training grants, right? And it's, you get
very not interested in Creative Commons. Like, I would say they're kind of the opposite of being interested in Creative Commons. And, you know, I'm interested in knowing, like, so I interact with them. They're my federal colleagues, and we have discussions about things and our relationship with each other, like education versus the copyright office, and who gets to say what things out loud, right? And it seems like there's some key talking points that some of the I guess, intellectual property equity, right, have. And it seems like one of the struggles that I always have, and perhaps this is because I don't do sufficient outreach to this community, is just sort of creating an evidence base that draws the picture of why this is important or the impact that this could have, right? So a lot of the difference between philanthropic money and public money is that public, there's like a million accountability mechanisms, right? And so I can't say like, here's my logic model and, you know, here's what good that could happen, right? And the impact that we could have. We have to demonstrate that there's evidence that this type of public investment can have a certain kind of outcome. And usually that's based on the evidence base in the past. And so this is sort of a chicken and egg situation, right? Because when you have a new thing, it's hard to have evidence of it because it's still new. And so I guess my key question is, could this group perhaps help us to define a set of research questions that we can all focus on answering so that when the time is there and when the relationships are there and when we have opportunity to propose like legislative changes or other public policy actions that we could have the sort of research base of, you know, data and evidence that we can look at and say, like, here's actually how you would define, like, commercial impact, or how here's actually how you would define, like, long-term economic impact and things like that.
Yeah, and if I were running this thing, yeah, one of the first decisions I would make would be to put you in charge.
Oh.
Having worked closely with you in the federal government. Those are exactly the right questions, and that's exactly the right approach. I mean, it's when I think about the last purple swan, that is the reason we're all here. They started with a bunch of questions. You know, would this work? Could this, what if we tried it a little bit this way? What if we tried it, and it's when you do something that's never been done before, you've got to arm yourself with the knowledge that failure is part of the process, and the failures are instructive. And from them you learn, but you keep as your North Star the goal. And the goal of the North Star goal ought to be, let's make it possible for anyone to rise academically from anywhere. How do we get there?
Yvonne in our office, Yvonne Eng, who's I think on the call, has circulated now a Google Doc that is to all of us and to all of the people who are in our group, and there are a lot of them who are not here today, that could be possibly a basis document, not because the text is so good, but just because it's a Google Doc, that we can fill in, with Cable's intervention, that we can fill in with Hal's and Sharon's. And I think for my part, it's like important to also figure out how to acknowledge the pressures against open and how many of them there are and how strong they are. And it's like one of two books that I've brought to this meeting today is this Declaration of Independence, this analysis of the drafting of the Declaration by Carl Becker from Cornell University, which I like to call a proper school. This is a history of the Declaration, and the Declaration goes in there, and I mean, when Jefferson drafted it and gave the first draft to Ben Franklin, it was all about, like, when in the course of and it listed all the things that the king was doing, all the things that were, in the end, tantamount to, you know, imposing tyrannical will upon people. And this is such a sophisticated book, I can't say enough about it. But, like, at some point, if we were to do our own declaration, if we were to do a souped-up Budapest declaration or something like that, in the way that Cable's talking about, I don't know whether it wouldn't be well-served as well to have a list of the grievances, in essence, that, you know, Elsevier foists upon us, or Google, or Twitter, or Trump, or the Kochs, or
can't say the COAST MIT.
Okay, the COAST.
A preamble. That's, you know,
that's
super long, like this preamble. Mm-hmm. And that's such a cool, inspirational thing. And it seemed to have worked, by the way.
Yes.
There's some evidence that, you know, these guys did it the right way.
Who is the audience for this, and how are we taking what we're talking about here as it's really reflecting of their interests and kind of what they want to get out of this? Is our audience broadly policymakers? Is it learners? Is it? I'm a little concerned about who's in the room and who's not in the room, and how we're designing kind of a call to action or list of grievances, where I feel like maybe some more voices. Of particularly around who we think these stakeholders are. So, you know, I'm interested in community colleges. I'm interested in community college students and community college outcomes, although, you know, see, it's set in this kind of broader context around open access, open education, and open pedagogy. And something that's missing maybe that we may want to include in this, Cable has been generating is some kind of contextualization of kind of how do you shift the culture or the conversation. It's one thing to publish kind of guidelines or kind of these kind of lofty goals of how you want to shift these things, but there's kind of an on-the-ground shift in culture. We've seen specifically educational culture is very entrenched, right? It's very hard to move without some really sophisticated approaches to and some intentional approaches to do that, which I think need to be part of this. Part of anything that we kind of declare or anything that we want to produce as a deliverable needs to be contextualized, and we need to seek input, I think, from who we want to benefit from these things.
I wonder, too, even just with the people we already have in the room, how quickly the shared list of grievances will start to get rather fuzzy. You know, Mark and I have a lot of conversations around the realities of statewide OER initiatives and what it's going to take to get this work done. And while I agree with what Hal said, the conversations he was having with Pearson and McGraw-Hill were egregious, there's an awful lot, too, that they are at least beginning to have conversations with us about that looks promising. You know, so, you know, where do we draw the line there in terms of, again, the boots on the ground practical application of this work and, frankly, the realities of sustaining it in institutions that are under-resourced to be able to make this work. You know, I look at Coppin State University up the road in Baltimore, you know, where Freddie Gray lost his life. That's the place that OER ought to be making the biggest impact, and they are the least able to get it done. They need, you know, some of these vendors, some of these OER providers to provide that additional support, and that comes at a cost. So, you know, I'm not sure where we draw the line on these grievances exactly when, you know, the realities that some of us are facing about how to get the work done, we're going to need some of those folks.
Before we put pen to paper collectively, I want to go back to something Cable mentioned last night when I saw him. There have been numerous documents over the years that the collective OER leadership around the world have put together, whether it's the Budapest Declaration, Cape Town Plus 10 a few years ago, the OER strategy document that Cable and Mary Lou and some others put together a few years ago. There are vision statements out there as a whole that we shouldn't ignore.
Certainly. They're all busy.
I mean, I know that Kurt and I share, Richard, your concern about not, you know, the room, who's in it, who's not in it. But at least we have a room. You know, like the first step is to get a room and then get some lasagna or whatever, pasta. No, but seriously, like, I don't know. I think there's so many things that we can do that are practical. And probably, MJ, the answer to, you know, where do we draw the line is to have a draft of that and then annotate it in the same way that these guys did.
Well, instead of it railing against a particular entity, it could be a set of high-level principles, you know, that says, you know, if we are going to work with you guys, here's how we expect you to behave.
The care framework.
I think I'm kind of getting exhausted to live in an age where we kind of identify all our enemies, because I'll tell you, living the last 4 years, that list that I'm is growing a mind, you know. And thank God there's somebody other than me living in my house that kind of keep me in check. I'm going to throw out a kind of a wild idea. It's probably not that wild, but I like to think that I have wild ideas from time to time. Granted, it makes me feel like a young Edison. Would it be too bold to ask some of these publishers, not all of them, because there's a couple I would not want to have conversations with right now, but maybe the Springers of the world, invite maybe, I don't know, I don't want to say Pearson, but are there publishers that we can invite, and when I say publishers, I mean commercial publishers, I mean. Are there some publishers that we should bring into a room and have this conversation with? Like, this is the direction we believe education needs to go in. Because, hell, when you're talking about open assessments, man, I'm thinking of like the North Country of New York State where there's no bandwidth, opioid epidemic, unemployment, people are locked in, they're not going anywhere, and that idea of an open assessment, like a prior learning assessment or some sort of path out of that world to a better world is what I want to fight for. I'd rather fight for something than against something else, you know what I mean? So is there an opportunity for us to bring people in who we normally don't talk to and maybe have identified historically as maybe counter to our goals and see if they've been nudged in any direction?
My thought there is, to what end, really? I mean, the enemy isn't the marketplace, right? The enemy is monopoly. So what we're interested in is, how do we diversify the marketplace?
Okay.
If we're talking about sustainability, you know, all of these open vendors also are charging, right? But they're in a different place from the Pearsons of the world. And my theory of change is a bit more bottom up. It's more, yes, you know, we have our principles and we have, you know, our guiding vision of where we want to get, but how do you enable that? What do you build that enables that? So if you're talking about, like, I'm not directly working in the OER space, so I'm more in the scholarly communication space, and, you know, I spend a lot of time working on tenure and promotion, and really the way to get where we want to get with academic careers is not sort of, realistically, we're not going to get all the provosts and presidents in a room and say, like, you should have different criteria, because part of the reason they have the criteria that they have is because there are workflows based on the tools and signals that they have. So how do you enrich the vocabulary of excellence in the production of knowledge, right? And I think there's a real, when I was listening to Hal, I was hearing something very similar. It's not about the content. It's about the underlying infrastructure. It's about the tools. It's about the assessment.
And the incentives.
So I was actually hoping that Joe would say something because, you know, in his work with the Open Syllabus Project, he's thinking about, credit and transferability of credit. I think you should talk about
that. Yeah, I'd love to hear. I'm so impressed with the work he's doing.
So this is not quantitative, it's not metrics, mm-hmm. It's descriptive. How do we, based on the material that goes into a course, how do we think about what's achieved by the student? And I think it's sort of similar to the space that I'm in. You know, if you create new ways of describing what contribution to scholarship is, there will be new metrics, right? And there might be markets around those metrics, but at least it's diversified. So I realize that this is only a part, maybe a small part of what you're all talking about here, but I think it's very important to sort of meet the vision with sort of, you know, practical tools and developments and, yeah.
Yeah, I'd love to hear what you have to say about all this.
Well, thank you for that setup. I have a two-hour talk about this if you have to.
I'll listen.
if you're not familiar with the Open Syllabus Project, just it's opensyllabus.org. You can dive into it for a few minutes and get a pretty good picture of what we're doing.
We're mapping the higher ed curriculum based on scraping of every publicly facing syllabus we can find online. That number's up to around 7 million in English now. And from that, we begin to extract some of the kind of simpler metadata, when the class took place, where it was, where the class was institutionally, what field is it in, and what texts are assigned. And so, you know, what we've done from my perspective, I tend to think of this as kind of layers of, you know, what are the types of data that constitute the stack for a class at a school? And at one level, you have the catalog and the kinds of visibility that are available to administrators of the university, you know, tend to be limited to the generality of the catalog, what's being taught based on class titles and maybe brief descriptions. But the level of understanding in a big school or department is pretty thin about what's actually happening in the department year to year. Below that is the sort of syllabus level, and that's where we've been working. And it turns out once you get that, you can begin to tie together some of these different questions about openness, open pedagogy, open access, and OER. We can begin to identify OER materials in the corpus and create demand metrics back to those communities. And you know, create a whole other kind of picture of the curriculum that really hasn't been available and just allow people to slice and dice it in different ways. And, you know, those sorts of applications are just beginning to open up. And then the layer that I think is below that, I mean, we're documenting what the class is supposed to be accomplishing, but then there's the question of what people are actually learning in the class. And, of course, the syllabus is a very rough account of that at best. But that's where the publishers are really, and learning management systems and all the people involved in that kind of classroom support layer are really developing data sets that I think are going to produce much more flexible, customizable, adaptive learning tools that risk just being much, much better than the kinds of open content that has been characteristic of the OER community over the years. So, you know, I share that concern that there's a risk of getting lapped here. And we've run into innumerable challenges of just trying to get universities to pay attention to this category of documents that exposes a different way of looking at the curriculum. They're generally very poorly managed. It's hard to get universities to understand the incentives of managing these documents properly, much less giving them to somebody else for analysis. So, I mean, we could talk at length about what those sorts of challenges are. We've tried to create a syllabus commons. We haven't really succeeded. But I think the most powerful tools looking forward are really going to be the ones that capture that lower level of actual student activity, actual student learning. You know, assessments is one way of talking about it. I think it's just going to be part of the classroom infrastructure to have supports that start with the content of the class but include everything else as well in a kind of singular system. That's where the publishers and ed tech companies are going. And I don't think it's a huge collective action problem. The universities are terrible at dealing with this sort of problem. It gets into some of the traditional weak sides of open source and open source software development because it's a kind of problem that will really favor centralized, really well-integrated development of a kind that open source is typically bad at. So I just sort of echo Hal's statement about where the next generation of problems are. And I think we're dealing with an interesting slice of it and running into some real obstacles that should be kind of cautionary in thinking about what more we can do. Just to your point about you know, curricular equivalencies, I mean, right now that's done at the course catalog level, if at all, right? There are agreements within state systems that students can circulate within the state system. Across state systems, there are some efforts to map catalog entry to catalog entry and say chemistry 101 here is going to be the same as chemistry 101 there. I think we can do that at a much more granular level of looking at the documents themselves. So if a student wants to submit a syllabus from their home school, we can look and see whether it matches a comparable syllabus at a destination school and really look at it at a deeper level than just the course description. So what are the learning outcomes? Do the texts feel like they're part of the same textual universe? And provide some both student-facing and administration-facing tools that allow some at least preliminary decisions about whether those kinds of equivalencies will work. We can do that in English now for probably 100 schools for which we have complete syllabus collections going back a certain number of years. the grail for me personally is to figure out how to do it for Europe.
Yeah.
Well, because we have dark collections of we've scraped most of Europe too, but it's in other languages, so we can't process.
And the other thing that allows for that is it doesn't have to be a course for course match anymore, right? It could be this set of courses that is equivalent to this set of courses. Because at the community college I'm leaving, you know, I may have gotten, you know, the first three competencies in the four-year institution in this course and the other six in this course, and those will add up to equivalency at the four-year institution, or that this whole set of things adds up, because we all teach different competencies in different courses, depending on how we've lined up our curriculum. So,
you said in the past that the amount of data you have allows you to establish some norms around the order in which concepts are actually taught,
yep.
Right, which is a new sort of insight. Yeah.
So that's what we're doing next, and we've kind of pulled out the easiest metadata from these documents. The next layer is harder because there are fewer standard ways of representing things like learning outcomes or course objectives or grading rubrics or assignment sequences. I mean, these are harder machine learning problems, but that's where we're headed.
Can I ask a follow-up question about that? So are you, as you're doing this, starting to create a standard rubric for describing this, or are you just leaning on how others described it to sort of collect, like, where you see the pattern?
Well, to date, we are reliant on other catalogs of either titles or institutions or fields. It's never going to be our comparative expertise to develop those kinds of taxonomies, so we'll take them where we can find them. We are involved with a couple projects that are looking at school-to-work transitions and working with kind of universe of competencies that one could apply both to curricular documents on one side and job descriptions or job announcements on the other, and see where the commonalities in kind of required skills and competencies are. Mm-hmm. So that's not our expertise, not my expertise, but obviously there's a tremendous amount of energy in this area, and we're beginning to figure out how to work with people who can do that.
Mm-hmm. Can I just want to pause for just a second and do a time and agenda check? One of the things that we found in our first meeting is the importance of trying to strike the balance between these really great open full group exchanges and the opportunities to break out into different teams. I think we're nearing the point here where we want to, for this moment, cap the big conversation. We'll have an opportunity after we wanted to kind of break out into these several themes that we identified in the first meeting and then come back together to kind of reintegrate things. So in no way is this anywhere near the end of these conversations, but I'd like to...
In 6 minutes?
Yeah.
5 minutes? I'm like 2:30? Break? Is that good?
Yeah, maybe just take a quick bio break, and then we'll divide up into the four themes if those still feel like the right thing.
Could I just give one 30-second ending intervention on this? Responding to Mark about who we might bring in, it dawns on me in the conversations we've had and what I just heard from you, and it's just I wanted to put this, that if there, I wouldn't want to necessarily bring in the public. You know who I think we could benefit from if we could bring into the room would be some pioneers in AI. These challenges that we're talking about this machine learning challenges and about where we are and wanting to develop next generation open assessments, it would be wonderful if we could make our global user community a kind of test bed for some ambitious artificial intelligence company that might want to use helping us achieve our goals, which we could describe as a test case for the power of their capacities in AI. And I would just love to marry some cutting-edge AI companies with our use cases and needs. That's the people I'd love to get into the room and say, how would the world's best AI company solve Joe's problem? You know, that's, by the way, sorry to keep talking, I apologize, but AI, if we want to be part of the future, we have to be swimming in that stream.
I wish I had thought of it. Shelley Blake Plock is just up the road in Baltimore. He would have been a great addition to this discussion.
Just to Mark's point, too, and just so you don't feel all alone in your house. As you were saying, you might sometimes
This idea of bringing in commercial companies into our discussion arose at the last meeting, and I think one of our group members, Chris Ford from the libraries at MIT, was suggesting let's wait. Let's wait until we know exactly or a little bit better where we want to go with some of our work, because when they come in, they're going to come in big or come in heavy or hard or whatever. And that's an interesting thing. I don't believe that we can ignore those market forces that are pressuring a lot of us in the other society, in the other direction. And I think that it's foolish to pretend that they don't exist.
Yeah. I also think we help to build that problem. I mean, that's the one thing I always say within the library community. We're in the process of negotiating with Elsevier, so please don't share that outside the four walls. But when we're sitting in the meeting with them, almost all the people who are negotiating with this company identify them as the enemy. And it's like, you know, pragmatically speaking, we help build that garden wall. Now we're trying to help break. We're trying to break the wall. And I'm trying to figure out what their solution is once the wall is broken. And nobody can tell me what their solution is once it's broken.
What would you do with?
Yeah.
I mean, it's all these major companies or publishers are becoming data and analytics companies.
Yeah. Well, that's what they say they're doing. Yeah. I think they are, but they're also still publishers.
What?
But they're still publishers, too. I mean, we're still purchasing published content from them.
Right.
So I agree they're data and analytics.
I think when we talk about, I think in the scholarly communication space, I mean, I think open access won. I think even the major publishers believe that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a model that they're, but there are all kinds of potential dystopian outcomes from that too that we need to grapple with.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, take us out.
On this point of existing power structures, I think we have to pay attention to them. We have a lot. They're grabbing our models and doing it better than we are, so, which is why I think whatever we publish should be so bold and so ideal in scope that either they do it, which would be wonderful, but I don't think they can do it, frankly, because they're for-profits which have different incentive systems than what we're thinking about. The point I wanted to make, though, is that the real power of open, and this is true, I think, of open source software, OA, OER, it doesn't matter what area of open you look at. The real power and the reason that the field and the movements are growing at the rate that they are is that the existing power structures can't stop local choices to move to open. So my school district, where our two boys go to school, are right now adopting open up resources materials, which are all CC BY licensed. Pearson hates it. I went to the procurement adoption meeting where the school district was considering all these different Common Core aligned curriculum, and Pearson and Wiley and everybody else were there, and they were throwing a fit that this was even being considered, but it wasn't up to them. It was up to the school district and the parents that were in the room to say, we want updated curriculum that the teachers have the legal rights to modify, improve, where the students can be participants in their own learning, and, by the way, that hits our budget with exactly a big fat zero in terms of how much it costs us. And then the district simply printed materials for kids that didn't have one-to-one laptop programs. And there was nothing that the big publishers could do about it. And that's at a district level. That's also true at the individual level, right? No, Pearson or Elsevier doesn't get to tell the faculty member at the University of Maryland, no, you can't publish in an OA journal. It's not their choice. Right? They can't tell the faculty member at the University of Washington, no, you can't put a CC license on your educational resources. It's not their choice. And when we talk about it in those terms, that the power actually resides with the individual or with the school districts or with the university, and that, yes, those are big, powerful structures, and, yes, they have billion-dollar budgets plus, but they don't have all the power, right? We can make those choices locally. And I think that's motivating to people. It's motivating to institutions to know that they have that power because they oftentimes don't realize that they do. So one of the pet projects I haven't done yet, I need to do, is to articulate some of this in what I've been calling open procurement. So, like with our school district where our boys go to school, I actually sat down with the school board and said, you have this power, and what you ought to do is create some criteria about what you adopt and, frankly, the licensing terms on what you adopt. So if you want to adopt Pearson, that's fine, but Pearson should be work for hire for you, the school district. So if you're going to shell out $500,000 for math curriculum, fine to give it to Pearson, but you own the copyright, and then you should make it OER by putting a CC BY license on it. Or if you want to skip that step and not wait for their stuff to be developed, here are other OER providers, CK12, Open Up Resources, IAM, and others, and they showed up at the procurement. Right? And then our school district made a choice. But it's a policy issue, right? We will not procure things that are not XYZ.
A local empowerment handbook or something like that would be awesome to distribute, especially if you were the author of it. So in terms of the breakout session, we have four theme teams, and that is
just every time he rolls his eyes, I came up with that phrase.
Theme team. Yay.
Like,
I don't know.
Theme team. Can we wear the same colored like sweatshirts?
Yeah, we should fissure it up. But just know that no one's restricted.
No,
one team, even if they're a team theme team, but a member of another team. But like when Kurt and I were blue skying this list, we were trying to be thinking of all kinds of deliverables, literally like a wiki, a video, a handbook, and people have begun annotating it. As you can see, Cable has put in that, Ross is annotating from the UK. So it would be great if in your meetings you could think of what might be deliverables. I know a number of you, James, you were busy on, you know, hunting down some of these too, like in your group, like, and Hal, it'd be great to come back and really think about tomorrow, today. Yeah. 4 o'clock, reassemble, is that okay? There's tiramisu cake out there.
I haven't seen any.
Yeah.
It got swept away. Did
it?
So we're convening in our small groups now, correct?
Yeah.
I'd say just maybe move to the corners of.
I think we have a hotel to ourselves. It doesn't appear to me that anybody else is.
The dental convention isn't in town yet.
Yeah.
All right.
Four? Is that okay? Four is an hour and a half.
Where are the groups listed?
On the agenda.
Yeah. So I can just talk down them real quick. Access, equity, inclusion. Angela, Brianna, James, Richard.
Richard and Brianna Swish.
Brianna Swish. Value propositions and incentives among the attendees here. That's MJ, Cable, and myself. Tools, infrastructure, and sustainability. That's Nicole, Ross, if we can continue to keep them dialed in. Amy, Mark, Sharon. Oh, wait, so this is where Brianna landed now? Yes, okay. You're on here twice.
Yeah, you're not.
Okay. You can't do that.
I can do it all, don't worry.
And then the Trust and Truth team with Peter and Hal and anybody else that you can
round up.
Recruit.
Yeah.
Peter, do you want to pitch the Trust and Truth team since I think we're sparsely populated, and
we are sparsely populated.
Is really quite exciting.
And sorry, I left. Let's see. Willem and Jeff are at the moment.
I will join the value proposition incentive.
Great. Extra crab cakes for those who want to join the trust.
Oh,
that's
me.
I don't know.
Oh,
yeah. You can need the crab cakes.
I would have. You had me a trust. I didn't need the crab cakes. Okay. All right.
Debs in on that. Anybody else? Okay.
Okay. Should we meet where?
Wherever you'd like.
Can we really go next door? Let's go to the Jim Henson room.
That's
yeah.
Is he friendly?
That's right.
Say goodbye to this one.
possible.